Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I was gonna play the can-kicking thing here, but then I figured that was getting old, so I'm just gonna come right out and say it. Congress is messing around with the economy again, y'all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 30th of September, the very last day of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I got some good news, and I got some bad news. The good news is that Congress has decided not to shut down the federal government. The bad news is that Congress has decided not to shut down the federal government.
You thought the uncertainty in October 1 was bad. Wait to see what it's going to be like in December when the short-term funding bill runs out and we go through it all again.
That's Stan Collender, a budget savant at Corvus in Washington, who we talk to from time to time, and he offers us our theme of the day, uncertainty, that the Congress, playing fast and loose with the federal budget, and the Fed, on whom everybody is waiting to make up its mind, aren't helping things economy-wise with their dithering.
There's no doubt that the government is adding to the uncertainty. So you get a combination of legislative and regulatory changes that are just not what the market's expecting, and that has to be uncertainty.
And the market hates uncertainty, as you know. The Fed meets next on interest rates at the end of October. The government is going to be funded until December the 11th. But in the meanwhile, there is a whole economy out there trying to figure out what's going on. Again, Lisa Goldenberg runs the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. She is one of our go-tos.
I guess this is where we were 2 years ago, right? The entire economy shuts down. We all get up and go to work every day and run our businesses. We're actually buying and selling and manufacturing things to keep ourselves and our employees employed and keep the economy going. So we need government's help to get on the same page so that everyone's keeping things moving forward.
Pretty sure I don't need to tell you this, but no, it is not supposed to work this way. So how did we get here? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams now on the rise of the stopgap government.
Continuing resolutions have been in the congressional toolbox since the 1800s, but Princeton's Julian Zelizer says the way they're used today is a more recent development.
Instead of a short-term fix, as they were used before the 1970s, instead they became the way in which we decide how much we're going to fund programs over the course of the year.
Blame Watergate, which led Congress to take control of the budget from the White House. The idea was to create a streamlined, open budget process. If that didn't work, continuing resolutions could be a backup plan. Or you could just use them all the time.
During all but three of the last 30 years, Congress has used continuing resolutions.
Michelle Sager is with the Government Accountability Office.
And they create uncertainty about when agencies will receive their final appropriations, as well as what the final level of funding will be.
And that uncertainty can be expensive.
It costs you more money to buy services in chunks in 3 or 4 months.
Max Steyer of the Partnership for Public Service estimates that costs billions. And remember, government workers have to prepare for a shutdown just in case.
The truth is that damage has already been done. We're already distracting people who are doing vital things for the American public from doing the jobs that we really want them to do.
In the case of Congress, the job people really want them to do starts with keeping the lights on. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I'll tell you what, if it's not one macroeconomic thing out there, it's another. Today is deadline day for Bank of America. Back in March, the frequently troubled bank only conditionally passed a Federal Reserve stress test, the hypotheticals that the Fed puts big banks through to see whether they can make it through another Lehman Brothers, for instance. B of A's retest results were due today, and Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports the bank had some work to do.
So Bank of America did not totally fail the Fed stress test this spring. It didn't totally pass it either, but it didn't totally fail. The Fed looked at Bank of America and it said, yeah, okay, you would have enough capital to get through another recession, but
Bank of America had what the Federal Reserve described as deficiencies in the qualitative side.
Stephen Bigar is with Argus Research. What does qualitative side even mean? It means Bank of America got the right answer on the test, but it didn't show enough of its work, or at least the Fed didn't like its work. David Hilder is senior bank analyst at Drexel Hamilton.
My sense is that what the Fed asks for is more detailed scenario analysis, business by business, region by region.
Bank of America has had trouble with three of its past five stress tests. A stock buyback plan was scrapped last year because of miscalculations. In 2011, the Fed shot down a plan to raise dividends.
In recent years, it's been among the weaker banks.
Anat Admati is professor of finance at Stanford. She says even if Bank of America passes with flying colors, she's still skeptical about stress tests in general.
They don't see through the entire complicated system. The system has a lot of connections across it, within it. The trouble is going to come from the things that are not in the models.
Value of stress tests aside, it's true that the next big surprise will be, by definition, a surprise. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today brings the third quarter of 2015 to a merciful close. They had a bit of a party on Wall Street to celebrate. Good riddance was the theme. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yesterday, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors added another $50 million to its budget to help fight homelessness. About a million of it's going to go to getting people off the streets this winter, more beds in shelters, because forecasts are for an unusually strong rainy season out here, thanks to a looming El Nino that you might have heard about. In a lot of cities, providing that kind of shelter is voluntary. Cities choose how many beds they want to have. About 60,000 or so New Yorkers live in shelters, and the city announced not too long ago it's going to spend an extra $1 billion over the next 4 years to help its homeless population. But New York City is different in one very big way when it comes to housing the homeless, and that is thanks largely to one man, as Marketplace's Noel King reports.
This story starts in a New York neighborhood called the Bowery in 1979. Kim Hopper was a grad student documenting how mentally ill New Yorkers survived there. He hung out at McSorley's, a bar that's still in the neighborhood. I met him there. He says the Bowery was known for three things.
Commercial lighting shops, flop houses, and a couple of very famous punk rock clubs.
It was New York's Skid Row. Hopper's now a professor at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Even 35 years later, he remembers.
Unless you could find a place to squirrel yourself away during the winter months and sort of catch some heat, you were really exposed to the elements, and that was a really harsh place to be.
Around that time, Hopper was introduced to Robert Hayes, a 26-year-old lawyer trying to do something unprecedented, to prove in court that New York City had a legal responsibility to shelter its thousands of homeless.
Here's this Wall Street lawyer who thinks he can move heaven and hell, let alone the city and state, to establish a right to shelter for people that nobody gave a damn about.
Robert Hayes is in his 60s now. He's gone gray, but still has lots of energy. He's the CEO of the nonprofit Community Healthcare Network. In 79, he was a newly minted securities and antitrust litigator at a white shoe law firm. He had a habit of chatting with the men who lived on the streets around NYU Law School.
Most people in New York either ignored homeless people or just figured they were out there by choice, kind of free thinkers, free livers, or down and out drunks.
But they were telling him living on the streets wasn't a choice.
I spent a lot of my spare time in the basement of the NYU Law Library and, dug around the legal books. And we did find some nuggets that gave us a straight-faced argument that there was indeed in New York a right to shelter.
His argument was this. In 1938, New York State rewrote its constitution. This was during the Depression, and a provision was added that said the following. The aid, care, and support of the needy are public concerns and shall be provided by the state.
You know, at the end of the day, the best argument I had was, Your Honor, the word shall provide emergency shelter means shall. Shall means shall. That's not complicated.
Hayes sued New York's mayor, the Department of Social Services, and Governor Hugh Carey. The plaintiff, Robert Callahan, was a homeless man Hayes met on the Bowery.
You know, Callahan was a spry, alcoholic guy who was in his 50s and literally said, I'm ready. Let's take on this Governor Carey. It'll be one Irish guy, Callahan, whooping another Irish guy, Carey. So that was the spirit.
Hayes called witnesses to testify that homelessness, especially in the winter, endangered lives. In December of 79, a judge agreed, ruling that homeless New Yorkers had a right to shelter. But Hayes knew it was only half a win because the city shelters were terrible. So he sued again and had witnesses describe the city shelters, the hundreds of men sleeping on metal beds with no mattresses, the clogged toilets, the violence. The testimony worked.
That afternoon, the city freaked out and came to the bargaining table, and we started negotiating a consent decree.
Hayes knows it was a big win, but it still feels partly like a failure. Youthful optimism had him convinced he'd help end homelessness. The 60,000 New Yorkers currently living in shelters prove he came up short. In New York, I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
It's not usually a vote of confidence when a stock spikes with news of the CEO's departure, but we are going to cut Ralph Lauren some slack. Shares up about 13% a day after Lauren announced he's going to step down from running the company he built, an empire, really, founded on one idea, aspirational luxury. No old money, no country club membership. All you got to do is put on a polo shirt and a cable-knit sweater, and you at least look the part. Come November, though, it's going to be up to a young Swedish guy named Stefan Larsson to bring the beleaguered brand into the future. He made his name, Larsson did, about as far from Lauren's world as you can get. Chains like H&M and Old Navy, which has the retail industry wondering just what type of brand Ralph Lauren is going to aspire to now. Our new fashion consultant, Andy Euler, has that story.
Talk to anyone in retail, and it won't be long until you hear this.
Fast fashion?
Fast fashion. That's what's selling these days, says Barbara Kahn. She's director of the Baker Retailing Center at the Wharton School. Think Forever 21, Zara, H&M. Fast fashion is where Stefan Larsson made his name. But that doesn't mean that's where Ralph Lauren is headed, at least not right away.
Gucci had a CEO from Unilever, and it didn't mean Gucci was going to go into soap.
Kahn says the brand, which includes Polo, Black Label, Purple Label, Club Monaco, many more, is so big, it's not just a matter of embracing a new fashion trend.
It's a very broad brand, and that's very difficult to manage. It goes from collection all the way down to outlet. I think it's more about being true to the brand.
But Barbara Thaw, who writes about retail for Forbes.com, thinks that brand actually needs some retooling, and sales have been slipping.
The mono brand, the look, the lifestyle, the Ralph Lauren preppy, upscale, aspirational aesthetic, that whole cookie-cutter aesthetic is waning.
The man who started it all isn't going anywhere, at least not immediately. Ralph Lauren will stay on as executive chairman with only slightly less at stake. Last week, he sold 50,000 shares in his company for $5.5 million. Maybe you should have waited. The stock was up almost 14% today. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A quick nod to the world of cars for just a second here. Tesla is out with its latest and greatest, the Falcon-winged, and those are Elon Musk's words, not mine, Model X. A couple of years ago, I went down to SpaceX, Musk's other company, to talk to him about rockets. And as happens sometimes in these interviews, my curiosity got the better of me. So this is a little off-the-wall question, but what is it about you and advanced modes of transportation between Tesla and this company?
In the case of Tesla, Tesla's about helping solve the sustainable transport problem. I think in terms of terrestrial technology problems, I think the biggest single problem that humanity faces in the 21st century is sustainable energy. So it's really from the context of, you know, what are important problems that I could potentially help solve that would make a difference to the world.
All of that is to say, round two, me and Elon coming up. I'm going up to Tesla next week to talk all things electric and cars. I'm going to drive one, too. Pretty excited about that. It's going to air next Friday, probably. Coming up.
I also milk the cow to get milk to make cheese and butter. I'd go to the ocean and get salt water.
And he killed the chicken, too. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 235 points today, 1.4%, 16,284. The NASDAQ climbed 102 points, 2.2%, finished at 4620. The S&P 500 increased 35 points, about 1.9%, 1920. We told you earlier about Bank of America resubmitting its stress test to the Fed. stock banked up 1.5%. Today, the fashion world is all a Twitter about Ralph Lauren, but other retail stocks are also in fashion today. Get it? Kate Spade up about 2.5%. Michael Kors added nearly 4%. Speaking about Twitter, the tech news site Recode is reporting that Twitter may be about to hire co-founder Jack Dorsey as its permanent, as in not temporary, CEO. Twitter up 5.2% today. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The economic news out of China continues to be glum to borderline lousy. A survey over there today by the People's Bank of China showed small business confidence, entrepreneurial confidence, is still falling as the third quarter expires. Not all things economic are straight business, though. At the end of July, China was chosen to host the 2022 Winter Olympic Games. The big ceremonies and some of the skating events are going to be held in Beijing. But a lot of the skiing is going to happen a couple of hours away up in the mountains. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz took a trip up there to what is rapidly becoming a mountain boomtown.
The doors to the office for China's Olympics bidding committee in the city of Zhangjiakou are secured with a bike lock. Committee officials sit inside smoking. Not a scene you'd imagine for a place that was just awarded the 2022 Olympics.
It was a good time to bid. In the end, it came down to just two countries.
Committee Deputy Director Zhang Chunsheng is proud Team China beat out Team Kazakhstan for the gold. He admits it was no coincidence there weren't any developed countries in the final bidding round.
People in more developed countries aren't sure whether the Olympics will be good for them, but people here want change. They hope the Olympics will bring more opportunity.
The question is, more opportunity for whom? Half an hour up in the mountains in the ski town of Chongli, it's clear who's got a head start.
We started construction on the four-star Tang-In Hot Spring Club, the Tangshan Villas, and the five-star Intercontinental Hotel.
Zhao Tierrey works for a developer that's building Four Seasons Town Dream Resort, no relation to the famous hotel chain. A 3D map at the sales office shows acres of ski runs, villas, and attractions that appeal to China's nouveau riche, things like a Royal Belgian homing pigeon base and an organic canteen. Out-of-town investors dressed in designer sunglasses and suits hop out of luxury SUVs to take a look. Zhao Fang bought a condo months ago before the Olympics announcement. Its value has risen by 20%, so she's come back to buy another.
I was thinking that if we got the Olympics, the price would suddenly rise like crazy. And that's what happened. I'm thrilled.
Somebody who's not so thrilled? A pair of local officials who've been tipped off that a foreign journalist is in town. They insist on escorting me wherever I go. I tell them they're about to become the main characters in this story. They think about that for a moment and then split. There's a reason why they're nervous. That I'll talk to people like this guy. Lu Wanku herds cattle. He's lived in this tiny brick home for more than 20 years. Now, it's in the way of a Four Seasons Town Dream Resort ski run. He says the local government's giving him a paltry few thousand dollars for his house. He's got 2 weeks to move out.
I guess I'll go further up into the mountains. Who can afford to live here anymore? I've never even seen people ski before, but they're building a resort on top of me. It doesn't matter. Who can stand in the way of the Olympics? You do what you're told.
That's the attitude in nearby Taizicheng, too. It's a farming village that'll soon be wiped off the map for the Olympic Village. In 7 years, thousands of athletes from all over the world will stay here. But now, in its final days, the only sign of life on the village's main street is a camel tied to a post chewing hay. He stands in front of a propaganda sign warning villagers about religious cults and drugs. A farmer on a tractor selling chicken parts drives past. Lu Junfang stops to chat on her way home from her cabbage field. She's lived here all her life.
I hope they build a new village for us. If they give us land, I suppose I'll continue to farm. If not, then I'll have to see.
One reason she seems so blasé is nobody here has heard where they'll be moved to. The other reason might be the local official who showed up as I began talking to her. Different one from the guys before, but just as jittery. I ask him where everyone's going to move. He doesn't know either. Up at the ski resort where the events will take place, marketing director Isaac Zhao shakes his head at all the confusion and the ballooning real estate bubble.
We've told the local government money is not what is needed right now. You need a plan. You need to let the world see that in 7 years, a small town like ours can host an international event. We've got a long way to go.
Local restaurant owner He Manyu agrees. He was a chef for Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping and a war hero from China's brief conflict with Vietnam in the late 70s. He's a communist through and through. His restaurant is adorned with photos of Chairman Mao. He says he's proud the motherland will host the Olympics, but he hopes the local proletariat gets something out of the deal.
Judging from the current situation, I don't think the Olympics will benefit the common people whatsoever. Land prices will climb sky high. But if you're a big businessman, you'll make millions. They're screwing it up for us locals.
As he says this, a customer tells him to be careful what he says to a foreign journalist. What? He yells back. It's the truth. He keeps an eye on his customer and says, the Communist Party tells the truth. In Chongli, Hebei Province, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You can find videos about pretty much anything on YouTube, as you know. As of today, there's also even a buy button of sorts, clickable ads that take you right to the advertiser's site. The other day, though, I saw a video that definitely did not make me want to buy something. A guy named Andy George in a series called How to Make Everything from Scratch, I should add there. The something in question was a chicken sandwich. It took him 6 months and $1,500, so of course we had to talk to him. Andy, it's good to have you on.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You spend 6 months of your life, $1,500 plus or minus, to make a sandwich. Why?
kind of just started out as a curiosity of what actually goes into the food we eat. How much work would it actually be to make something entirely from scratch? How much would it actually cost, and how would it taste?
You broke it down into steps, and you literally, I mean, except for like birthing, you know, the chicken and all that, I mean, you did everything, right?
Yeah, I tried to go to as fundamental as like you could find it in nature.
Walk me through it. What were the first couple of things you did?
Well, the first thing I had to do was plant my garden, planted all my vegetables, including wheat. Had to care for that for 6 months. And I also milked the cow to get milk to make cheese and butter. I'd go to the ocean and get salt water to boil down to make salt.
I can't decide which was my favorite part, you making the salt or you killing the chicken, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it was definitely a unique experience that I hadn't done before. A little bit shocking.
6 months later, $1,500 plus or minus. Well, wait, how'd you come up with the $1,500 figure? How'd you do the line item budgeting?
So I kept track of all the expenses I directly had to pay, and that was a little bit over $500. And then I factored in the amount of time I put into it, which was almost 200 hours. And then I factored that with minimum wage, and that was about $1,000. So that's how it got to the $1,500 price point.
But for instance, I mean, you know, I did a little research, right? You paid $20 to get that chicken and to slaughter it and pluck it and all that stuff. You could have had like three chicken sandwiches for $20.
Yeah. And I had a bunch of extra vegetables and other stuff. But it's like if you want one sandwich, you can have a lot of extra stuff. So like my goal was one sandwich. So they can't make just enough to make one sandwich.
Well, that's right. What did you learn in the end then? I mean, you set out to sort of, I don't know, I guess rediscover the food chain. What'd you learn?
It's kind of how complicated just our society is. That something that seems so simple takes a lot of work, and there's just countless people involved that just take for granted.
This isn't the only how-to film you've made. I just watched one that was how to make a bottle. There's also how to make a $4,000 suit in only 10 months. And I will say, just spoiler alert, you kind of failed at making a suit.
It wasn't too bad.
No, it was pretty bad, man. I saw the video. What is, other than like what's next, what's your dream how-to video?
Like my big lofty goal I'd really like to do is to make a house all the way from scratch, like make my own fiberglass, cut down my own trees to make the lumber, and just do every step to make that. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Andy George, he made a $1,500 sandwich, took him 6 months, and he filmed it. It's online on YouTube. It's called How to Make Everything. Andy, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Just because I know you want to know, here's what he thought of his $1,500 sandwich. This is straight from the video.
It's not bad. That's about it. It's not bad. 6 months of my life were not bad. Yeah.
I mean, you feel kind of bad, right? You can check out the rest of it. It's at marketplace.org. It's worth 3 minutes of your time. Trust me. All right, this final note on the way out today, in which the lengths to which some people will go for a good internet prank reach what might be their upper limit. Next time you get a second, go to flypigeon.co, not com, just .co. Your message anywhere you want by carrier pigeon. It is kind of amazing, honestly, for an internet joke. At least, I think it's a joke. Now watch, that stupid pigeon thing is real, right? The Dow up 235 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 102, that is 2.2%. The S&P 500 increased 35 points, 1.9%. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.